to the third case of the day, in re Jumer's Castle Lodge. Mr. Koenig?
Hi, I'm Phil Koenig. I'm here on behalf of the Unsecured Creditors Committee in the bankruptcy of Jumer Castle Lodge Incorporated. We filed a state court or an Illinois state law fraudulent conveyance action. The bankruptcy court granted the defendant summary judgment. The district court in Peoria affirmed the summary judgment. We're here asking for a reversal of that summary judgment and state that as a major thesis that there is a significant factual dispute as to the value of the property that the defendant transferred to the debtor corporation, that he managed as a consequence of that transfer, and the value established to overvalue the real estate by as much as $2.5 billion, and thereby benefit himself to the extent that he discharged indebtedness of his own to the debtor company. The mere presence of an appraisal here indicates, and we had the premises appraised, the value established by the appraiser was $2.1 million. The defendant valued the property at $4.5 million for purposes of the transfer. As with any, in addition to that, the defendant later on challenged the assessment placed upon the property by the Knox County Board of Review and claimed that the property was worth $2.5 million when in fact it was valued at $4.5 million for purposes of transferring the property to the debtor corporation. This inconsistency as to the value of the real estate is in and of itself enough of a factual issue that summary judgment should not have been granted. This case is affected by Rule 56, just like any other case in federal court, and that summary judgment is not to be granted is to be granted only when there are no factual issues, and that as a matter of law, the moving party is entitled to judgment in its favor.
Well, even if your appraisal that the Galesburg property is worth only $2.1 million is correct, isn't the value of the assets the debtor receives still greater than those received by
Jumer? No, Your Honor, it is not. No, Your Honor, it is not. The bankruptcy court miscalculated, in our opinion, what the debtor got in exchange for what the debtor gave. The bankruptcy court included in the calculation the amount of money that the sale of stock to the Serenow Group added to what the defendant got. However, the sale of the stock to the Serenow Group is a transaction that stood on its own 2 feet.
Does Illinois apply the step transaction doctrine?
So far as I know, the rulings by the by this court and the court sitting under it.
No, I didn't ask anything about federal courts. I asked whether Illinois law, which controls here, since this is an Illinois statute that's being used, whether Illinois applies the step transaction.
I am not aware that they do.
Does that mean you know that they don't, or you just haven't done any research on that question?
I have researched it. I am not aware. I do not have an answer to give you, Your Honor. I am not aware that they do. I think the statute is plain and simple. It analyzes...
The standard bankruptcy treatise says that all 50 states use the step transaction doctrine for questions of this sort. Now, is that wrong?
No, I do not believe it is wrong. However, as this is a state court transaction, the measurement is what was given in exchange for what was...
Well, but if the step transaction doctrine applies, then why aren't all of these transactions stepped together since they were contingent on each other?
I think the transaction can be viewed together, but I'm saying that a third party comes in and purchases a 30% or a third interest in the corporation for consideration independent of what my client or what the defendant was to give. The defendant made a deal that he would pay back not less than $1 million of what was owed by the sister corporations to the debtor. He then goes out and finds an appraisal that would allow him only to give $1 million back to the debtor corporation in settlement of the accounts receivable that he had with the debtor corporation. The transaction for the purchase of the stock was an independent, in other words, if we use the got and receive analysis, Serrano got a 30% interest in exchange for the money it gave.
Let me try to put it a little different way. Considering that Serrano's payment of $2 million to the debtor was conditioned upon JCL entering into the agreement for the sale of real property with Jumer, why is it improper to include the $2 million in the valuation of the assets that the debtor received in the transfer? What's wrong with that?
What's wrong with that picture is that the debtor was shorted $2 million on the accounts receivable that the defendant had with the debtor. The debtor purchased real estate from the defendant.
Well, counsel, you're not addressing the question that was asked.
Excuse me. In what respect? I'll be happy to. I'm trying to answer it.
We're trying to figure out whether, as a matter of Illinois law, all of the funds that went into the debtor and all of the assets that went out get put together in one pot.
And they do.
But
even if they do, we are shorted by $2 million.
I don't know what you mean by you say we are shorted by $2 million. On your accounting, there's about $5.1 million that goes in. So how does $7.1 million come out?
If we look at the analysis of the bankruptcy court, we look to what was transferred to the defendant. Accounts receivable totaling approximately $4.2 million. I'll be quick.
Just looking at the numbers, the transfers to JCL, the value was 5.368, and then the transfers to Jumer were 4.497652, right?
No. The transfers to Jumer were over $4.3 million. The transfers to Jumer Castle Lodge should only be the consideration. The Jumer Castle Lodge canceled $4.2 million in debt for the receipt of a $2 million piece of property. Alongside that, a third party purchased a 30% interest in the corporation. The money that the defendant and the debtor had exchanged were between the debtor and the corporation. Serrano bought the stock not from the defendant, but from the corporation. So his transfer is an independent transaction with the debtor corporation.
Yeah, well, that's, of course, just what gets me to ask whether the step transaction doctrine applies. That's the scope of the step transaction doctrine. It's putting together transactions that are nominally independent, but economically related.
And while they are economically related, the debtor corporation was still shorted $2 million by its exchange.
That's where I lose you. If we include them all, it looks like Jumer is getting new assets that are worth, by your accounting, more than $5 million and paying out assets that are worth, by your accounting, less than $5 million. And therefore, it must be getting reasonably equivalent value because more than $5 million exceeds less than $5 million. How is there a $2 million difference here?
The $2 million that you're... The defendant received accounts receivable, cancellation of accounts receivable of $4.2 million, $100,000 in life insurance, and three automobiles. He put in $1 million and transferred a $2 million piece of real estate. That means there's a shortfall of $2 million.
Not if the step transaction doctrine is applied, right? We have separate questions. One, whether the step transaction doctrine applies. And two, whether if it does, there's a shortfall. You can't answer the question whether the step transaction doctrine applies by asserting that there's a shortfall if it doesn't.
I think the question here is what this court has decided in previous cases as we analyze what was given and what was received. And the existence or non-existence of the step transaction doctrine, I think in any transaction, the court can look at the totality of the circumstances. But even if you look at the totality of the circumstances, there was independent consideration paid for what Serenow gave the debtor. Serenow did not give the defendant the money and let the defendant put the money in. Serenow gave the money to the debtor corporation.
Right. I think we have your position.
I hope I reserved enough time for rebuttal. Thank you.
You didn't,
but
we'll see if there's a need for that. Mr. Dury?
First of all, the step transaction is adopted in Illinois. Illinois almost exclusively relies upon federal law in fraudulent conveyance cases because the body of case law in Illinois that's been developed is very sparse, and we are authorized to follow.
Is there some Illinois case you rely on for the proposition that the state has adopted the step transaction doctrine?
I have not. I personally was unable to find one. Maybe there's one judge, and maybe it's our failure, but the court below did, in fact,
indicate. What does it say? Look, this is just the Illinois version of the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act.
Right.
The step transaction doctrine is normal in litigation under the Fraudulent Transfer Act. What does Illinois say about the extent to which it follows other states' decisions understanding or applying the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act?
As the court indicated, and I was of the same understanding, all 50 states follow the step transaction where these nominally independent...
You just told me that you've looked and found that Illinois hasn't said anything one way or the other.
I didn't
find it. I'm trying now to figure out what has Illinois said about its general attitude toward other states' decisions under the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act.
It has indicated they are to be followed and be considered persuasive, and we are also to follow the federal court decisions under 544.
There are no federal decisions under the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act. What state case do you want me to look at for its attitude toward other states' interpretations of the Uniform Act?
If you could bear with me a second, Your Honor. The case that I found and the case that the court below cited was the same one. The court made it clear that Illinois law favors relying upon this court's or the federal district court's the federal appellate court's decisions in determining in fraudulent conveyance issues. And there was such a citation.
I must say I don't understand what you're saying. The only reason we are here is because the provisions of the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act differ from those of federal law. If you just look at the bankruptcy code, this action is filed too late, for example. This litigation cannot exist under federal law.
Cited in the decision of the U.S. District Court below on appeal was a case in which, on the issue of whether reasonably equivalent consideration
was
had.
That's not the question I'm asking. Why don't you proceed?
Well, at any rate, as I understand it, the step transaction doctrine is universally followed by all states.
But you just told me that you did research and couldn't find any Illinois case.
I did not find an Illinois case that specifically said that.
Well, it's not uniformly.
I found Illinois cases which basically steer us to the federal decisions and to the decisions of other states. All right. On the issue of what constitutes reasonably equivalent consideration. I will simply say there are a couple of cases that seem to be cited in many, if not all, fraudulent conveyance cases since their original issuance, and I think they're equally applicable to this one. We all know the In re Rote case, or Rote, however you pronounce it, which set forth four factors for the court to apply in determining whether reasonably equivalent value was received by a debtor when that is an issue in a fraud and law case. The four are: Was the value transferred essentially equal? What was the market value of what was transferred and received? Was the transaction at arm's length? And was the transferee in good faith? Now the court in In re Joy Recovery Technology simply stated the inquiry as follows: what did the debtor give up and what did it receive to benefit its creditors? Now we contend that it is therefore appropriate to take a look at this transfer from the creditor's standpoint on the day before and the day after this transaction occurred. Let's take the day before. We know the corporation was in trouble. That's not in dispute. The facts have been recited by both courts below. We know that the corporation was not able to fully service its indebtedness. And we know a number of receivables were included on the books as assets, including one that, with interest, had a face value of over $2.7 million, but a real or actual market value of next to nothing, actually $17,000. Now, the day after this challenge transaction, the debtor had received clear title to unencumbered commercial property in Galesburg, Illinois, on and out of which an ongoing hotel concern was being operated. The debtor also received a $1 million payment from the defendant. The debtor also received, according to the step transaction, or as the cases say, collapsing these transactions into one where they're related and conditioned upon each other, a $2 million cash infusion paid by the Serenault Gaming investors. Also got two parcels of land adjacent to the Peoria Hotel, suitable for future expansion, valued at $100,000. And last but not least, in terms of hard cold cash, the debtor was benefited by the termination of its lease obligation to the defendant, Mr. Jumer, on the Galesburg real estate, freeing up $14,000 a month or $168,000 a year in cash flow. The courts also cite, and there was evident, undisputed evidence, that the motive of this restructuring of assets was also to better place the debtor in a position to attract future investment and to obtain quality future financing. And they all felt that this had been accomplished. Now, and to get all of that, the defendant had to agree to accept assets, including the worthless $2.7 million receivable from another Jumer company, along with other assets worth a little over $1.6 million. Now, the point of it is Mr. Jumer had not guaranteed that $2.7 million. At least there's no evidence in the record to suggest that he did, and the plaintiff has not so claimed. So the defendant not only surrendered $3.2 million using the plaintiff's figures in a $2.1 million hotel property and $1 million of his own plus two additional parcels of land worth $100,000, but he surrendered his right to rental income on unencumbered property that he owned outright, but he did so knowing, as everyone knew, and as is undisputed in this case, that he was really receiving about half that total in return. And again, I would point out to you that we keep talking about how he bolted on this debt. The issue is guarantee, all right? There was no evidence that he had guaranteed these receivables that he accepted, and particularly, I recall, no evidence, and I looked through the file again just in preparation for today, no evidence, no claim that there was a personal guarantee which could have been enforced against him on this $2.7 million debt. Now, there's one other thing he did, and that was he agreed to a significant diminution of his ownership interest in the hotel corporation that he had formed and brought along, built, and flourished with so many years, so that the buyers of a 30% interest, that 30% interest that diminished his ownership interest, would put $2 million directly into the company to help shore it up and keep it going. If we look at the cases, the Imray Imaging case, the Joy Technology case, there is no question that these benefits, direct or indirect, that are fairly concrete, may be taken into consideration in terms of whether or not reasonably equivalent value was given. And here, $2 million is fairly concrete, and it did go directly into this company. There's no dispute about that. Now, the clear inference is the defendant did so believing that his company would benefit, and he believed that the creditors would benefit also. It's obvious and highly reasonable inference that he was motivated by his own, if he had been motivated by his own finances, he would have kept the $1 million. He would have refused this deal. He would have kept the unencumbered Galesburg property and protected them from not only creditors, who they were having trouble paying, but the possibility of a bankruptcy down the road if all this didn't work out. So it seems to me rather indisputable, an indisputable inference that the interests of the creditors of this debtor were in far better shape, better protected as a result of this transaction the day after it was signed than the day before. And I think the courts below, and particularly the bankruptcy court, although it made a small mathematical error based upon the value of a gas station, which the district court picked up on, the courts below laid out these calculations, comparative calculations. These aren't made-up figures. This is what happened in this case. And this guy was trying to save his business, the very business that bore his name. And that's it. That's all we have to say. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to try to field them.
I guess not. Thank you, Mr. Drake.
Thank you.
Mr. Kennedy, your time had expired, but you may have a minute.
May it please the court, and thank you for indulging me. The comment to the, first of all, the debtor or the defendant made the comment that there was no personal guarantee of the debt. As I raised in my brief, the defendant had a fiduciary duty as an officer and a director of the corporation to marshal assets for the benefit of the corporation and for the benefit of the creditors. What he did instead was benefit himself by coming away with $2 million from money that he had previously taken from the corporation. While I am not accustomed and familiar, the step transaction notion was not used in cases that I was able to discover. However, Joy Recovery and other cases discuss indirect benefit. And the case that counsel mentioned, that indirect benefit has to show some benefit to the creditors, and there was none here by overvaluing a building for purposes of not satisfying in full money that had already been taken out of the company by the defendant. Thank you, Your Honors, and I'd be happy to answer any further questions.
All right. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to both counsel. Case taken under advisement.